Roland stood for a moment, lost in thought. Then he turned to Ted.
"Bring one with half a brain left in his head," Roland instructed. "Tell him Dan Sewer, Dan Tour, Dan Roland, Dan Gilead. Tell it back."
Without hesitation, Ted repeated it. Roland nodded.
"If he still hesitates, tell him Chevin of Chavin says he must come. They speak a little plain, do they not?"
"Sure," Dinky said. "But, mister, you couldn't let a rod come up here and see you and then turn him free again. Their mouths are hung in the middle and run on both ends."
"Bring one," Roland said, "and we'll see what we see. I have what my Kamai Eddie calls a hunch. Do you ken hunch think?"
Ted and Dinky nodded.
"If it works out, fine. If not, be assured that the fellow you bring will never tell what he saw here."
"You'd kill him if your hunch doesn't pan out?"
Ted asked.
Roland nodded.
Ted gave a bitter laugh.
"Of course you would. It reminds me of the part in Huckleberry Finn when Huck sees a steamboat blow up. He runs to Miss Watson and the widow Douglas with the news, and when one of them asks if anyone was killed, Huck says with perfect aplomb, 'No, ma'am, only a nigger.' In this case, we can say, 'Only a rod. Gunslinger man had a hunch, but it didn't pan out.'"
Roland gave him a cold smile, one that was unnaturally full of teeth. Eddie had seen it before and was glad it wasn't aimed at him. He said,
"I thought you knew what the stakes were," sighed Ted. "Did I misunderstand?"
Ted met his gaze for a moment, then looked down at the ground. His mouth was working. During this, Dinky appeared to be engaged in silent palaver with Stanley. Now he said,
"If you want a rod, we'll get you one. It's not much of a problem. The problem may be getting here at all. If we don't..."
Roland waited patiently for the young man to finish. When he didn't, the gunslinger asked,
"If you don't, what would you have us do?"
Ted shrugged. The gesture was such a perfect imitation of Dinky's that it was funny.
"The best you can," he said. "There are also weapons in the lower cave. A dozen of the electric fireballs they call sneeches. A number of machine guns, what I've heard some of the low men call speed shooters. The U.S. Army AR-15s. Other things we're not sure of.
One of them's some kind of sci-fi ray gun like in a movie," Dinky said. "I think it's supposed to disintegrate things, but either I'm too dumb to turn it on, or the battery's dead."
He turned anxiously to the white-haired man.
5 minutes are up and more. We have to put an egg in our shoe and beat it, Tedster. Let's chug."
"Yes, well, we'll be back tomorrow. Perhaps by then you'll have a plan."
"You don't?"
Eddie asked, surprised.
"My plan was to run, young man. It seemed like a terribly bright idea at the time. I ran all the way to the spring of 1960. They caught me and brought me back, with a little help from my young friend Bobby's mother. And now we really must—"
"One more minute, do it please you," Roland said, and stepped toward Stanley. Stanley looked down at his feet, but his beard-scruffy cheeks once more flooded with color, and—"He's shivering," Susanna thought, "like an animal in the woods, faced with its first human being." Stanley looked perhaps 35, but he could have been older. His face had the carefree smoothness Susanna associated with certain mental defects. Ted and Dinky both had pimples, but Stanley had none. Roland put his hands on the fellow's forearms and looked earnestly at him. At first, the gunslinger's eyes met nothing but the masses of dark, curly hair on Stanley's bowed head. Dinky started to speak. Ted silenced him with a gesture.
"Will ye not look me in the face?" Roland asked.
He spoke with a gentleness Susanna had rarely heard in his voice.
"Will ye not, before you go, Stanley? Son of Stanley. She me that was."
Susanna felt her mouth drop open. Beside her, Eddie grunted like a man who has been punched. She thought, "But Roland's old. So old. Which means that if this is the tavern boy he knew in Magus, the one with the donkey and the pink sombrero hat, then he must also be—" The man raised his face slowly. Tears were streaming from his eyes.
"Good old Will Dearborn," he said.
His voice was hoarse and jigged up and down through the registers as a voice will do when it has lain long unused.
"I'm so sorry, Si. Were you to pull your gun and shoot me,
I'd understand."
"So I would."
"Why do you say so, Shimi?"
Roland asked in that same gentle voice. Stanley's tears flowed faster.
You saved my life. Arthur and Richard, too, but mostly you. Good old Will Dearborn, who was really Roland of Gilead. And I let her die. Her that you loved. And I loved her, too.
The man's face twisted in agony, and he tried to pull away from Roland, yet Roland held him.
None of that was your fault, Shimi.
I should have died for her, he cried. I should have died in her place. I'm stupid. Foolish, as they said.
He slapped himself across the face, first one way and then the other, leaving red wheels. Before he could do it again, Roland seized the hand and forced it down to his side again.
"'Twas Rhea did the harm," Roland said.
Stanley, who had been Shimi an eon ago, looked into Roland's face, searching his eyes.
"Aye," Roland said, nodding. "'Twas the Coos, and me as well. I should have stayed with her. If anyone was blameless in the business, Shimi, Stanley, it was you."
"Do you say so, gunslinger?
Truly true?" Roland nodded. "We'll palaver all you would about this, if there's time. And about those old days, but not now. No time now. You have to go with your friends, and I must stay with mine."
Shimi looked at him a moment longer. And yes, Susanna could now see the boy who had bustled about a long-ago tavern called the Traveler's Rest, picking up empty beer schooners and dropping them into the wash barrel which stood beneath the two-headed elk's head that was known as the Romp, avoiding the occasional shove from Coral Thorin or the even more ill-natured kicks that were apt to come from an aging whore called Petty the Trotter. She could see the boy who had almost been killed for spilling liquor on the boots of a hardcase named Roy de Pape. It had been Cuthbert who had saved Shimi from death that night. But it had been Roland, known to the townsfolk as Will Dearborn, who had saved them all. Shimi put his arms around Roland's neck and hugged him tight. Roland smiled and stroked his curly hair with his disfigured right hand. A loud, honking sob escaped Shimi's throat. Susanna could see the tears in the corners of the gunslinger's eyes.
"Aye," Roland said, speaking in a voice almost too low to hear. "I always knew you were special. Bert and Alain did, too. And here we find each other, well met further down the path. We're well met, Shimi, son of Stanley. So we are. So we are."
Chapter 6 The Master of Blue Heaven 1 Pimley Prentice, the Algociento master, was in the bathroom when Finley, known in some quarters as the Weasel, knocked at the door. Prentice was examining his complexion by the unforgiving light of the fluorescent bar over the washbasin. In the magnifying mirror, his skin looked like a grayish, crater-pocked plain, not much different from the surface of the wastelands stretching in every direction around the Algol. The sore on which he was currently concentrating looked like an erupting volcano.
"Who be for me?"
Prentice bawled, although he had a pretty good idea.
"Finley Otago."
"Walk in, Finley."
Never taking his eyes from the mirror, his fingers closing in on the sides of the infected pimple looked huge. They applied pressure. Finley crossed Prentice's office and stood in the bathroom door. He had to bend slightly in order to look in. He stood over 7 feet, very tall even for a Taheen.
"Back from the station like I was never gone," said Finley.
Like most of the Taheen, his speaking voice reeled wildly back and forth between a yelp and a growl. To Pimley, they all sounded like the hybrids from H.G. Wells' The Island of Dr. Moreau, and he kept expecting them to break into a chorus of "Are We Not Men?" Finley had picked this out of his mind once and asked about it. Prentice had replied with complete honesty, knowing that in a society where low-grade telepathy was the rule, honesty was ever the best policy, the only policy, when dealing with the Taheen. Besides, he liked Finley Otago.
"Back from the station, good," Pimley said. "And what did you find?"
A maintenance drone. Looks like it went rogue on the Ark 16 side and—
Wait, Prentice said. If you will, thanks. Finley waited. Prentice leaned even closer toward the mirror, face frowning in concentration. The Master of Blue Heaven was tall himself, about 6'2", and possessed of an enormous sloping belly supported by long legs with slab thighs. He was balding and had the turnip nose of a veteran drinker. He looked perhaps 50. He felt like about 50, younger when he hadn't spent the previous night tossing them back with Finley and several of the Cantoi. He had been 50 when he came here, a good many years ago. At least 25, and that might be a big underestimation. Time was goofy on this side, just like direction, and you were apt to lose both quickly. Some folkin lost their minds as well, and if they ever lost the sun machine for good, the top of the pimple bulged, trembled, burst. Ah! A glut of bloody pus leaped from the site of the infection, splattered onto the mirror, and began to drool down its slightly concave surface. Pimley Prentice wiped it off with the tip of a finger, turned to flick it into the Jakes, then offered it to Finley instead. The Taheen shook his head, then made the sort of exasperated noise any veteran dieter would have recognized, and guided the master's finger into his mouth. He sucked the pus off, and then released the finger with an audible pop.
"Shouldn't do it. Can't resist," Finley said. "Didn't you tell me that folkin on the other side decided eating rare beef was bad for them?"
"Yar,"
Pimley said, wiping the pimple, which was still oozing, with a Kleenex. He had been here a long time, and there would never be any going back, for all sorts of reasons, but until recently he had been up on current events. Until the previous, could you call it a year, he'd gotten the New York Times on a fairly regular basis. He bore a great affection for the Times, loved doing the daily crossword puzzle. It was a little touch of home.
"But they go on eating it just the same."
"Yar, I suppose many do."
He opened the medicine cabinet and brought out a bottle of hydrogen peroxide from Rexall.
"It's your fault for putting it in front of me," Finley said. "Not that such stuff is bad for us ordinarily. It's a natural sweet like honey or berries. The problem's Thunderclap."
And, as if his boss hadn't gotten the point, Finley added,
"Too much of what comes out of it don't run the true thread, no matter how sweet it might taste. Poison, do you?"
Prentice dampened a cotton ball with the hydrogen peroxide and swabbed out the wound in his cheek. He knew exactly what Finley was talking about. How could he not? Before coming here and assuming the master's mantle, he hadn't seen a blemish on his skin in well over 30 years. Now, he had pimples on his cheeks and brow, acne in the hollows of his temples, nasty nests of blackheads around his nose, and a cyst on his neck that would soon have to be removed by Gangley, the compound doctor. Prentice thought Gangley was a terrible name for a physician. It reminded him both of ganglion and gangrene. The Taheen and the Cantoi were less susceptible to dermatological problems, but their flesh often broke open spontaneously. They suffered from nosebleeds and even minor wounds. The scrape of a rock or a thorn could lead to infection and death, if not promptly seen to. Antibiotics had worked a treat on such infections to begin with, not so well anymore. Same with such pharmaceutical marvels as Accutane. It was the environment, of course, death baking out of the very rocks and earth that surrounded them. If you wanted to see things at their worst, you only had to look at the rods, who were no better than slow mutants these days. Of course, they wandered far to the... was it still the southeast? They wandered far in the direction where a faint red glow could be seen at night, in any case, and everyone said things were much worse in that direction. Pimley didn't know for sure if that was true, but he suspected it was. They didn't call the lands beyond Fedic the Discordia because they were vacation spots.
"One more?" he asked Finley. "I've got a couple on my forehead that are ripe."
"Nay, I want to make my report, double-check the videotapes and telemetry, go on over to the study for a quick peek and then sign out. After that I want a hot bath, and about 3 hours with a good book. I'm reading The Collector."
"And you like it?" Prentice said, fascinated.
Very much say thank you. It reminds me of our situation here, except I like to think our goals are a little nobler and our motivations a little higher than sexual attraction.
Noble? So you call it?
Finley shrugged and made no reply. Close discussion of what was going on here in Blue Heaven was generally avoided by unspoken consent. Prentice led Finley into his own library study, which overlooked the part of Blue Heaven they called the Mall. Finley ducked beneath the light fixture with the unconscious grace of long practice. Prentice had once told him, after a few shots of graph, that he would have made a hell of a center in the NBA. "The first all-Taheen team," he'd said. "They'd call you the Freaks. But so what?"
"These basketball players, they get the best of everything?"
Finley had inquired. He had a sleek weasel's head and large black eyes, no more expressive than doll's eyes in Pimley's view. He wore a lot of gold chains, they had become fashionable among Blue Heaven personnel, and a brisk trading market in such things had grown up over the last few years. Also, he'd had his tail docked. "Probably a mistake," he'd told Prentice one night when they'd both been drunk. "Painful beyond belief, and bound to send him to the hell of darkness when his life was over, unless there was nothing." This was an idea Pimley denied with all his mind and heart, but he'd be a liar if he didn't admit, if only to himself, that the idea sometimes haunted him in the watches of the night. For such thoughts there were sleeping pills. And God, of course. His faith that all things served the will of God, even the tower itself. In any case, Pimley had confirmed that, yes, basketball players, American basketball players at least, got the best of everything, including more pussy than a fucking toilet seat. This remark had caused Finley to laugh until reddish tears had seeped from the corners of his strangely inexpressive eyes. "And the best thing," Pimley had continued, "is this. You'd be able to play near forever by NBA standards. For instance, do you hear, the most highly regarded player in my old country, although I never saw him play, he came after my time, was a fellow named Michael Jordan, and—"
"If he were Taheen, what would he be?"
Finley had interrupted. This was a game they often played, especially when a few drinks over the line.
"A weasel, actually, and a damned handsome one,"
Pimley had said, and in a tone of surprise that had struck Finley as comical. Once more, he'd roared until tears came out of his eyes. "But," Pimley had continued, "his career was over in hardly more than 15 years, and that includes a retirement and a comeback or two. How many years could you play a game where you'd have to do no more than run back and forth the length of a compa court for an hour or so, Finn?" Finley of Tego, who was then over 300 years old, had shrugged and flicked his hand at the horizon. De la, years beyond counting. And how long had Blue Heaven, Divar Toy to the newer inmates, Algol Siento to the Taheen and the Rods, how long had this prison been here? Also De La. But if Finley was correct, and Pimley's heart said that Finley almost certainly was, then De La was almost over. And what could he, once Paul Prentice of Rahway, New Jersey, and now Pimley Prentice of the Algol Siento, do about it? His job. That was what. His fucking job. 2.
"So," Pimley said, sitting down in one of the two wing chairs by the window, "you found a maintenance drone. Where?"
"Close to where Track 97 leaves the switching yard," said Finley. "That track's still hot. Has what you call a third rail. And so that explains that. Then, after we'd left, you call and say there's been a second alarm."
"Yes, and you found?"
"Nothing," Finley said. "That time, nothing. Probably a malfunction, maybe even caused by the first alarm."
He shrugged, a gesture that conveyed what they both knew. It was all going to hell. And the closer to the end they moved, the faster it went.
"You and your fellows had a good look, though."
"Of course. No intruders."
But both of them were thinking in terms of intruders who were human, Taheen, Cantoy, or mechanical. No one in Finley's search party had thought to look up, and likely would not have spotted Mordred, even if they had. A spider, now as big as a medium-sized dog, crouched in the deep shadow under the main station's eave, held in place by a little hammock of webbing.
You're going to check the telemetry again because of the second alarm?
Partly, Finley said. Mostly because things feel hinky to me.
This was a word he'd picked up from one of the many other side crime novels he read. They fascinated him, and he used it at every opportunity.
Hinky how?
Finley only shook his head. He couldn't say.
But telemetry doesn't lie, or so I was taught.
You question it?
Aware he was on thin ice again, that they both were, Finley hesitated and then decided what the hell.
These are the end times, boss. I question damn near everything.
Does that include your duty, Finley Otego?
Finley shook his head with no hesitation. No, it didn't include his duty. It was the same with the rest of them, including the former Paul Prentice of Rowway. Finley remembered some old soldier, maybe dugout Doug MacArthur, saying, "When my eyes close in death, gentlemen, my final thought will be of the Corps, and the Corps, and the Corps." Pimley's own final thought would probably be of Algolciento. Because what else was there now? In the words of another great American, Martha Reeves, of Martha and the Vandellas, they had nowhere to run, baby, nowhere to hide. Things were out of control, running downhill with no brakes. And there was nothing left to do but enjoy the ride.
"Would you mind a little company as you go your rounds?" Pimley asked.
"Why not?"
the weasel replied. He smiled, revealing a mouthful of needle-sharp teeth, and sang in his odd and wavering voice,
"Dream with me. I'm on my way to the moon of my fathers."
"Give me 1 minute," Pimley said, and got up.
"Prayers?"
Finley asked. Pimley stopped in the doorway.
"Yes," he said, "since you ask. Any comments, Finley Otego?"
"Just one, perhaps."
The smiling thing with the human body and the sleek brown weasel's head continued to smile.
"If prayer's so exalted, why do you kneel in the same room where you sit to shit?"
"Because the Bible suggests that when one is in company, one should do it in one's closet. Further comments?"
"Nay, nay,"
Finley waved a negligent hand.
"Do thy best and thy worst, as the many say."
3. In the bathroom, Paul O'Rourway closed the lid on the toilet, knelt on the tiles, and folded his hands.
"If prayer's so exalted, why do you kneel in the same room where you sit to shit? Maybe I should have said because it keeps me humble," he thought, "because it keeps me right-sized. It's dirt from which we arose, and it's dirt to which we return, and if there's a room where it's hard to forget that, it's this one." "God," he said, "grant me strength when I am weak, answers when I am confused, courage when I am afraid. Help me to hurt no one who doesn't deserve it, and even then, not unless they leave me no other choice. Lord."
And while he's on his knees before the closed toilet seat, this man, who will shortly be asking his God to forgive him for working to end creation, and with absolutely no sense of irony, we might as well look at him a bit more closely. We won't take long, for Pimley Prentice isn't central to our tale of Roland and his quartet. Still, he's a fascinating man, full of folds and contradictions and dead ends. He's an alcoholic who believes deeply in a personal God, a man of compassion who is now on the very verge of toppling the tower and sending the trillions of worlds that spin on its axis flying into the darkness in a trillion different directions. He would quickly put Dinky Earnshaw and Stanley Ruiz to death if he knew what they'd been up to. And he spends most of every Mother's Day in tears, for he loved his own Ma dearly and misses her bitterly. When it comes to the apocalypse, here's the perfect guy for the job, one who knows how to get knee-bound and can speak to the Lord God of hosts like an old friend. And here's an irony. Paul Prentice could be right out of the ads that proclaim, "I got my job through the New York Times." In 1970, laid off from the prison then known as Attica, he and Nelson Rockefeller missed the mega riot at least, he spied an ad in the Times with this headline: "Wanted, experienced corrections officer, for highly responsible position in private institution. High pay, top benefits, must be willing to travel." The high pay, it turned out to be what his beloved Ma would have called a pure D, high corn lie. because there was no pay at all. Not in the sense an America-side corrections officer would have understood, but the benefits. Yes, the bennies were exceptional. To begin with, he'd wallowed in sex, as he now wallowed in food and booze. But that wasn't the point. The point, in Cy Prentice's view, was this. What did you want out of life? If it was to do no more than watch the zeros increase in your bank account, then clearly Algolciento was no place for you. Which would be a terrible thing, because once you had signed on, there was no turning back. It was all the core and the core. And every now and then, when an example needed to be made, a corpse or two. Which was 100% okay fine with Master Prentice, who had gone through the solemn Tahin name-changing ceremony some 12 years before and had never regretted it. Paul Prentice had become Pimley Prentice. It was at that point he had turned his heart, as well as his mind, away from what he now only called America side. And not because he'd had the best baked Alaska and the best champagne of his life here, not because he'd had sim sex with hundreds of beautiful women, either. It was because this was his job, and he intended to finish it. Because he'd come to believe that their work at the Divar Toy was God's as well as the Crimson King's. And behind the idea of God was something even more powerful, the image of a billion universes tucked into an egg, which he, the former Paul Prentice of Rahway, once a $40,000-a-year man with a stomach ulcer and a bad medical benefits program okayed by a corrupt union, now held in the palm of his hand. He understood that he was also in that egg, and that he would cease to exist as flesh when he broke it. But surely, if there was heaven and a God in it, then both superseded the power of the tower. It was to that heaven he would go, and before that throne he would kneel to ask forgiveness for his sins. And he would be welcomed in with a hearty, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant." His ma would be there, and she would hug him, and they would enter the fellowship of Jesus together. That day would come, Pimley was quite sure, and probably before Reap Moon rolled around again. Not that he considered himself a religious nut, not at all. These thoughts of God and heaven he kept strictly to himself. As far as the rest of the world was concerned, he was just a Joe doing a job, one he intended to do well to the very end. Certainly he saw himself as no villain, but no truly dangerous man ever has. Think of Ulysses S. Grant, that Civil War general who'd said he intended to fight it out on this line if it took all summer. And the Algolciento? Summer was almost over. 4. The master's home was a tidy Cape Cod at one end of the mall. It was called Shapley House. Pimley had no idea why. And so, of course, the breakers called it Shit House. At the other end of the mall was a much larger dwelling, a gracefully rambling Queen Anne called, for equally obscure reasons, Damley House. It would have looked at home on Fraternity Row at Clemson or Ole Miss. The breakers called this one Heartbreak House, or sometimes Heartbreak Hotel. Fine. It was where the Tahin and a sizable contingent of Cantoy lived and worked. As for the breakers, let them have their little jokes, and by all means, let them believe that the staff didn't know. Pimley Prentice and Finley Otego strolled up the mall in companionable silence, except that was when they passed off-duty breakers, either alone or in company. Pimley greeted each of them with unfailing courtesy. The greetings they returned varied from the completely cheerful to sullen grunts. Yet each made some sort of response, and Pimley counted this a victory. He cared about them. Whether they liked it or not, many didn't. He cared about them. They were certainly easier to deal with than the murderers, rapists, and armed robbers of Attica. Some were reading old newspapers or magazines. A foursome was throwing horseshoes. Another foursome was on the putting green. Tanya Leeds and Joey Rostosovich were playing chess under a graceful old elm, the sunlight making dapples on their faces. They greeted him with real pleasure, and why not? Tanya Leeds was now actually Tanya Rostosovich, for Pimley had married them a month ago, just like the captain of a ship. And he supposed that in a way that was what this was, the good ship Algolciento, a cruise vessel that sailed the dark seas of Thunderclap in her own sunny spotlight. The sun went out from time to time, say true, but today's outage had been minimal, only 43 seconds.
"How's it going, Tanya, Joseph?"
Always Joseph and never Joey, at least not to his face. He didn't like it. They said it was going fine, and gave him those dazed, fuck-struck smiles of which only newlyweds are capable. Finley said nothing to the Rostosoviches, but near the Damley House end of the mall, he stopped before a young man sitting on a faux marble bench beneath a tree, reading a book.
"Sirenshaw?"
the Tahin asked. Dinky looked up, eyebrows raised in polite inquiry. His face, studded with a bad case of acne, bore the same polite no expression.
"I see you're reading the Magus," Finley said almost shyly. "I myself am reading The Collector. Quite a coincidence."
"If you say so," Dinky replied. His expression didn't change.
"I wonder what you think of Fowles. I'm quite busy right now, but perhaps later we could discuss him."
Still wearing that politely expressionless expression, Dinky Earnshaw said, "Perhaps later you could take your copy of The Collector, hardcover, I hope, and stick it up your furry ass, sideways." Finley's hopeful smile disappeared. He gave a small but perfectly correct bow.
"I'm sorry you feel that way, Si."
"The fuck out of here," Dinky said, and opened his book again. He raised it pointedly before his face. Pimley and Finley Otego walked on. There was a period of silence, during which the master of Algolciento tried out different approaches to Finley, wanting to know how badly he'd been hurt by the young man's comment. The Tahin was proud of his ability to read and appreciate Hume literature, that much Pimley knew. Then Finley saved him the trouble by putting both of his long-fingered hands, his ass wasn't actually furry, but his fingers were, between his legs.
"Just checking to make sure my nuts are still there," he said,
and Pimley thought the good humor he heard in the chief of security's voice was real, not forced.
"I'm sorry about that," Pimley said. "If there's anyone in Blue Heaven who has an authentic case of post-adolescent angst, it's Si Earnshaw."
"You're tearing me apart,"
Finley moaned, and when the master gave him a startled look, Finley grinned, showing those rows of tiny, sharp teeth.
"It's a famous line from a film called Rebel Without a Cause," he said. "Dinky Earnshaw makes me think of James Dean."
He paused to consider.
"Without the haunting good looks, of course."
"An interesting case," Prentice said. "He was recruited for an assassination program run by a positronic subsidiary. He killed his control and ran. We caught him, of course. He's never been any real trouble, not for us. But he's got that pain-in-the-ass attitude."
"But you feel he's not a problem?"
Pimley gave him a sideways glance.
"Is there something you feel I should know about him?"
"No, no. I've never seen you so jumpy as you've been over the last few weeks. Hell, call a spade, so paranoid."
"My grandfather had a proverb," Pimley said. "You don't worry about dropping the eggs until you're almost home. We're almost home now."
And it was true. 17 days ago, not long before the last batch of wolves had come galloping through the door from the ARC-16 staging area, their equipment in the basement of Damley House had picked up the first appreciable bend in the Bear Turtle beam. Since then, the beam of Eagle and Lion had snapped. Soon, the breakers would no longer be needed. Soon, the disintegration of the second-to-last beam would happen with or without their help. It was like a precariously balanced object that had now picked up a sway. Soon, it would go too far beyond its point of perfect balance, and then it would fall. Or in the case of the beam, it would break. Wink out of existence. It was the tower that would fall. The last beam, that of wolf and elephant, might hold for another week or another month, but not much longer. Thinking of that should have pleased Pimley, but it didn't. Mostly because his thoughts had returned to the green cloaks. 60 or so had gone through Kalabound last time, the usual deployment, and they should have been back in the usual 72 hours with the usual catch of Kala children. Instead, nothing. He asked Finley what he thought about that. Finley stopped. He looked grave.
"I think it may have been a virus," he said.
"Cry pardon?"
"A computer virus. We've seen it happen with a good deal of our computer equipment in Damley, and you want to remember that no matter how fearsome the Greencloaks may look to a bunch of rice farmers, computers on legs is all they really are."
He paused.
"Or the Kala Folkin may have found a way to kill them. Would it surprise me to find that they'd gotten up on their hind legs to fight? A little, but not a lot. Especially if someone with guts stepped forward to lead them."
"Someone like a gunslinger, mayhap?" Finley gave him a look that stopped just short of patronizing. Ted Brodigan and Stanley Ruiz rode up the sidewalk on 10-speed bikes, and when the master and the security had raised hands to them, both raised their hands in return. Brodigan didn't smile, but Ruiz did, the loose, happy smile of a true mental defective. He was all eye boogers, stubbly cheeks, and spit-shiny lips, but a powerful bugger just the same. Before God he was, and such a man could do worse than chum around with Brodigan, who had changed completely since being hauled back from his little vacation in Connecticut. Pimley was amused by the identical tweed caps the two men were wearing. Their bikes were also identical, but not by Finley's look.
"Quit it," Pimley said.
"Quit what, Si?"
Finley asked, looking at me as if I were a little kid who just lost the top of his ice cream cone and doesn't have the wit to realize it. But Finley didn't back down. He rarely did, which was one of the things Pimley liked about him.
"If you don't want folk to look at you like a child, then you mustn't act like one. There have been rumors of gunslingers coming out of Midworld to save the day for 1,000 years and more, and never a single authenticated sighting. Personally, I'd be more apt to expect a visit from your man Jesus."
"The rods say—" Finley winced as if this actually hurt his head.
"Don't start with what the rods say. Surely you respect my intelligence and your own more than that. Their brains have rotted even faster than their skins. As for the wolves, let me advance a radical concept. It doesn't matter where they are or what's happened to them. We've got enough booster to finish the job, and that's all I care about."
The security head stood for a moment at the steps that led up to the Damley House porch. He was looking after the two men on the identical bikes and frowning thoughtfully.
"Brodigan's been a lot of trouble."
"Hasn't he just?" Pimley laughed ruefully. "But his troublesome days are over. He's been told that his special friends from Connecticut, a boy named Robert Garfield and a girl named Carol Gerber, will die if he makes any more trouble. Also, he's come to realize that while a number of his fellow breakers regard him as a mentor, and some, such as the soft-headed boy he's with, revere him, no one is interested in his philosophical ideas, shall we say. Not any longer, if they ever were. And I had a talk with him after he came back, a heart-to-heart." This was news to Finley.
"About what?"
"Certain facts of life. Cy Brodigan has come to understand that his unique powers no longer matter as much as they once did. It's gone too far for that. The remaining two beams are going to break with him or without him, and he knows that at the end there's apt to be confusion. Fear and confusion." Pimley nodded slowly. "Brodigan wants to be here at the end, if only to comfort such as Stanley Ruiz when the sky tears open."
"Come, let's have another look at the tapes and the telemetry, just to be safe."
They went up the wide wooden steps of Damley House, side by side. 5. Two of the Cantoi were waiting to escort the master and his security chief downstairs. Pimley reflected on how odd it was that everyone, breakers and Algolciento staff alike, had come to call them the low men, because it was Brodigan who coined the phrase. "Speak of angels, hear the flutter of their wings," Prentice's beloved ma might have said, and Pimley supposed that if there were true manimals in these final days of the true world, then the Cantoi would fill the bill much better than the Tahin. If you saw them without their weird living masks, you would have thought they were Taheem, with the heads of rats. But unlike the true Taheen, who regarded Humes, less a few remarkable exceptions, such as Pimli himself, as an inferior race, the Kantoi worshipped the human form as divine. Did they wear the masks in worship? They were close-mouthed on the subject, but Pimli didn't think so. He thought they believed they were becoming human, which was why, when they first put on their masks, these were living flesh, grown rather than made. They took a Hume name to go with their Hume aspect. Pimli knew they believed they would somehow replace human beings after the fall, although how they could believe such a thing was entirely beyond him. There would be heaven after the fall, that was obvious to anyone who'd ever read the Book of Revelation. But Earth? Some new Earth, perhaps. But Pimli wasn't even sure of that. Two Kantoi security guards, Beeman and Trelawney, stood at the end of the hall, guarding the head of the stairs going down to the basement. To Pimli, all Kantoi men, even those with blonde hair and skinny builds, looked weirdly like that actor from the 40s and 50s, Clark Gable. They all seemed to have the same thick, sensual lips and batty ears. Then, when you got very close, you could see the artificial wrinkles at the neck and behind the ears, where their Hume masks twirled into pigtails and ran into the hairy, toothy flesh that was their reality, whether they accepted it or not. And there were the eyes. Hair surrounded them. And if you looked closely, you could see that what you originally took for sockets were, in fact, holes in those peculiar masks of living flesh. Sometimes you could hear the masks themselves breathing, which Pimli found both weird and a little revolting.
"I'll," said Beeman.
"I'll," said Trelawney.
Pimli and Finley returned the greeting. They all fisted their foreheads, and then Pimli led the way downstairs. In the lower corridor, walking past the sign which read, "We must all work together to create a fire-free environment," and another reading, "All hail the Kantoi," Finley said very low, "They are so odd." Pimli smiled and clapped him on the back. That was why he genuinely liked Finley Otego. Like Ike and Mike, they thought alike. 6. Most of the Damley House basement was a large room jammed with equipment. Not all of the stuff worked, and they had no use for some of the instruments that did. There was plenty they didn't even understand. But they were very familiar with the surveillance equipment and the telemetry that measured darks, units of expended psychic energy. The Breakers were expressly forbidden from using their psychic abilities outside of the study, and not all of them could, anyway. Many were like men and women, so severely toilet-trained that they were unable to urinate without the visual stimuli that assured them that, yes, they were in the toilet, and yes, it was all right to let go. Others, like children who aren't yet completely toilet-trained, were unable to prevent the occasional psychic outburst. This might amount to no more than giving someone they didn't like a transient headache or knocking over a bench on the mall. But Pimley's men kept careful track, and outbursts that were deemed on purpose were punished. First offenses lightly, repeat offenses with rapidly mounting severity. And as Pimli liked to lecture to the newcomers, back in the days when there had been newcomers, "Be sure your sin will find you out." Finley's scripture was even simpler. Telemetry doesn't lie. Today they found nothing but transient blips on the telemetry readouts. It was as meaningless as a 4-hour audio recording of some group's farts and burps would have been. The videotapes and the swing guards' daybooks likewise produced nothing of interest.
"Satisfied, Sai?"
Finley asked, and something in his voice caused Pimli to swing around and look at him sharply.
"Are you?"
Finley Otego sighed. At times like this, Pimli wished that either Finley were Hume or that he himself were truly Taheen. The problem was Finley's inexpressive black eyes. They were almost the shoe-button eyes of a Raggedy Andy doll, and there was simply no way to read them. Unless maybe you were another Taheen.
I haven't felt right for weeks now, Finley said at last. I drink too much graft to put myself asleep, then drag myself through the day, biting people's heads off. Part of it's the loss of communications since the last beam went.
You know that was inevitable.
Yes, of course I know. What I'm saying is that I'm trying to find rational reasons to explain irrational feelings, and that's never a good sign.
On the far wall was a picture of Niagara Falls. Some Cantoy guard had turned it upside down. The low men considered turning pictures upside down the absolute height of humor. Pimney had no idea why. But in the end, who gave a shit?
I know how to do my fucking job, he thought, rehanging Niagara Falls right side up.
I know how to do that, and nothing else matters. Tell God and the man Jesus thank you.
We always knew things were going to get wacky at the end, Finley said. So I tell myself that's all this is, this, you know...
This feeling you have, the former Paul Prentice supplied. Then he grinned and laid his right forefinger over a circle made by his left thumb and index finger. This was a Taheen gesture which meant, I tell you the truth, this irrational feeling.
Yar. Certainly I know that the bleeding lion hasn't reappeared in the north, nor do I believe that the sun's cooling from the inside. I've heard tales of the Red King's madness, and that the Dantiti has come to take his place, and all I can say is I'll believe it when I see it. Same with this wonderful news about how a gunslinger man's come out of the west to save the tower, as the old tales and songs predict. Bullshit, every bit of it.
Pimley clapped him on the shoulder. Does my heart good to hear you say so.
It did, too. Finley Otego had done a hell of a job during his tenure as head. His security cadre had had to kill half a dozen breakers over the years, all of them homesick fools trying to escape. And two others had been lobotomized, but Ted Brodigan was the only one who'd actually made it under the fence. This phrase Pimley had picked up from a film called Stalag 17. And they had reeled him back in, by God. The Cantoy took the credit and the security chief let them, but Pimley knew the truth. It was Finley who'd choreographed each move from beginning to end.
But it might be more than just nerves, this feeling of mine, Finley continued. I do believe that sometimes folk can have bona fide intuitions.
He laughed.
How could one not believe that? In a place as lousy with precogs and postcogs as this one.
But no teleports, Pimley said. Right?
Teleportation was the one so-called wild talent of which all the Divar staff was afraid, and with good reason. There was no end to the sort of havoc a teleport could wreak. Bringing in about 4 acres of outer space, for instance, and creating a vacuum-induced hurricane. Fortunately, there was a simple test to isolate that particular talent, easy to administer, although the equipment necessary was another leftover of the old people, and none of them knew how long it would continue to work. And a simple procedure, also left behind by the old ones, for shorting out such dangerous organic circuits. Dr. Gangley was able to take care of potential teleports in under 2 minutes.
So simple it makes a vasectomy look like brain surgery, he'd said once. Abso-fackin-lutely, no teleports, was what Finley said now, and led Prentice to an instrument console that looked eerily like Susanna Dean's visualization of her Dogen.
He pointed at 2 dials marked in the hen-scratch of the old people, marks similar to those on the unfound door. The needle of each dial lay flat against the 0 mark on the left. When Finley tapped them with his furry thumbs, they jumped a little and then fell back.
We don't know exactly what these dials were actually meant to measure, he said, but one thing they do measure is teleportation potential. We've had breakers who've tried to shield the talent, and it doesn't work. If there was a teleport in the woodpile, Pimlio, New Jersey, these needles would be jittering all the way up to 50 or even 80.
So, half smiling, half serious, Pimley began to count off on his fingers. No teleports, no bleeding lion stalking from the north. No gunslinger man
Oh, and the green cloaks succumbed to a computer virus. If all that's the case, what's gotten under your skin? What feels hinky-die-die to you?
The approaching end, I suppose.
Finley sighed heavily.
I'm going to double the guard in the watchtowers tonight, any row. And Hume's along the fence as well.
Because it feels hinky-die-die. Pimley smiling a little.
Hinky-die-die. Yar.
Finley did not smile. His cunning little teeth remained hidden inside his shiny brown muzzle. Pimley clapped him on the shoulder. Come on, let's go up to the study. Perhaps seeing all those breakers at work will soothe you.
Perhaps it will,
Finley said, but he still didn't smile. Pimley said gently, It's all right, Finn.
I suppose,
said the Tahin, looking doubtfully around at the equipment, and then at Beeman and Trelawney, the two lowmen who were respectfully waiting at the door for the two big bugs to finish their palaver.
I suppose 'tis.
Only his heart didn't believe it. The only thing he was sure his heart believed was that there were no teleports left in Algol Siento. Telemetry didn't lie. 7. Beeman and Trelawney saw them all the way down the oak-paneled basement corridor to the staff elevator, which was also oak-paneled. There was a fire extinguisher on the wall of the car, and another sign reminding Divar Folkin that they had to work together to create a fire-free environment. This, too, had been turned upside down. Pemley's eyes met Finley's. The master believed he saw amusement in his security chief's look, but of course what he saw might have been no more than his own sense of humor reflected back at him like a face in a mirror. Finley untacked the sign without a word and turned it right side up. Neither of them commented on the elevator machinery, which was loud and ill-sounding, nor on the way the car shuddered in the shaft. If it froze, escape through the upper hatch would be no problem, not even for a slightly overweight, well, quite overweight fellow like Prentice. Damley House was hardly a skyscraper, and there was plenty of help near at hand. They reached the third floor, where the sign on the closed elevator door was right side up. It said, Staff only, and please use key, and go down immediately if you have reached this level in error. You will not be penalized if you report immediately. As Finley produced his key card, he said with a casualness that might have been feigned, God damn his unreadable black eyes, Have you heard from Cy Sayre? No. Pimley said, rather crossly, nor do I really expect to. We're isolated here for a reason, deliberately forgotten in the desert just like the scientists of the Manhattan Project back in the 1940s. The last time I saw him, he told me it might be, well, the last time I saw him.
Relax, Finley said. I was just asking.
He swiped the key card down its slot, and the elevator door slid open with a rather hellish scree sound. 8. The study was a long, high room in the center of Damley, also oak-paneled and rising 3 full stories to a glass roof that allowed the Algol's hard-won sunlight to pour in. On the balcony opposite the door through which Prentice and the Tego entered was an odd trio consisting of a raven-head Tahin named Jackley, a Cantoy technician named Conroy, and 2 Hume guards whose names Pimley could not immediately recall. Tahin, Cantoy, and Humes got on together during work hours by virtue of careful and sometimes brittle courtesy, but one did not expect to see them socializing off-duty. And indeed the balcony was strictly off-limits when it came to socializing. The breakers below were neither animals in a zoo nor exotic fish in an aquarium. Pimley, Finley Otego as well, had made this point to the staff over and over. The master of Algol Siento had only had to lobo 1 staff member in all his years here, a perfectly idiotic Hume guard named David Burke, who had actually been throwing something, had it been peanut shells, down on the breakers below. When Burke had realized the master was serious about lobotomizing him, he begged for a second chance, promising he'd never do anything so foolish and demeaning again.
Pimley had turned a deaf ear. He'd seen a chance to make an example which would stand for years, perhaps for decades, and had taken it. You could see the now truly idiotic Mr. Burke around to this day, walking in the mall or out by Leftard's boundary, mouth slack and eyes vaguely puzzled. I almost know who I am. I almost remember what I did to end up like this, those eyes said. He was a living example of what simply wasn't done when one was in the presence of working breakers. But there was no rule expressly prohibiting staff from coming up here, and they all did from time to time, because it was refreshing. For one thing, being near working breakers made talk unnecessary. What they called good mind kicked in as you walked down the third-floor hall on either side, from either elevator, and when you opened the doors giving on the balcony, good mind bloomed in your head, opening all sorts of perceptual doorways. Aldous Huxley, Pimley had thought on more than one occasion, would have gone absolutely bonkers up here. Sometimes one found one's heels leaving the floor in a kind of half-assed float. The stuff in your pockets tended to rise and hang in the air. Formerly baffling situations seemed to resolve themselves the moment you turned your thoughts to them. If you'd forgotten something, your 5 o'clock appointment or your brother-in-law's middle name, for instance, this was the place where you could remember. And even if you realized that what you'd forgotten was important, you were never distressed. Falcon left the balcony with smiles on their faces, even if they'd come up in the foulest of moods. A foul mood was an excellent reason to visit the balcony in the first place. It was as if some sort of happy gas, invisible to the eye and unmeasurable by even the most sophisticated telemetry, always rose from the breakers below. The two of them hailed the trio across the way, then approached the wide fumed oak railing and looked down. The room below might have been the capacious library of some richly endowed gentleman's club in London. Softly glowing lamps, many with genuine Tiffany shades, stood on little tables or shone on the walls, oak-paneled, of course. The rugs were the most exquisite Turkish. There was a Matisse on one wall, a Rembrandt on another, and on a third was the Mona Lisa, the real one, as opposed to the fake hanging in the Louvre on Keystone Earth. A man stood before it with his arms clasped behind him. From up here he looked as though he were studying the painting, trying to decipher the famously enigmatic smile, maybe, but Pimley knew better. The men and women holding magazines looked as though they were reading too, but if you were right down there, you'd see that they were gazing blankly over the tops of their McCalls and their Harpers, or a little off to one side. An 11- or 12-year-old girl in a gorgeous striped summer dress that might have cost $1,600 in a Rodeo Drive kitty boutique was sitting before a dollhouse on the hearth, but Pimley knew she wasn't paying any attention to the exquisitely made replica of Damley at all. 33 of them down there. 33 in all. At 8 o'clock, an hour after the artificial sun snapped off, 33 fresh breakers would troop in, and there was one fellow, one and one only, who came and went just as he pleased. A fellow who'd gone under the wire and paid no penalty for it at all, except for being brought back, that was, and for this man, that was penalty enough. As if the thought had summoned him, the door at the end of the room opened and Ted Brodigan slipped quietly in. He was still wearing his tweed riding cap. Danica Rostov looked up from the dollhouse and gave him a smile. Brodigan dropped her a wink in return. Pimley gave Finley a little nudge. Finley, I see him. But it was more than seeing, they felt him. The moment Brodigan came into the room, those on the balcony, and, much more important, those on the floor, felt the power level rise. They still weren't completely sure what they'd gotten in Brodigan. And the testing equipment didn't help in that regard. The old dog had blown out several pieces of it himself. And on purpose, the master was quite sure. If there were others like him, the low men had found none on their talent hunts, now suspended. They had all the talent they needed to finish the job. One thing that did seem clear was Brodigan's talent as a facilitator, a psychic who was not just powerful by himself, but was able to up the abilities of others just by being near them. Finley's thoughts, ordinarily unreadable even to Breakers, now burned in Pimley's mind like neon.
Finley, he is extraordinary.
Pimley, and so far as we know, unique. Have you seen the thing? Image, eyes growing and shrinking, growing and shrinking.
Finley, yes. Do you know what causes it?
Pimley, not at all. Nor care, dear Finley, nor care. That old? Image, an elderly mongrel with burdocks in his matted fur, limping along on three legs. Has almost finished his work, almost time to... Image, a gun, one of the Hume Guard's Berettas, against the side of the old mongrel's head. Three stories below them, the subject of their conversation picked up a newspaper. The newspapers were all old now, old like Brodigan himself, years out of date. Sat in a leather-upholstered club chair so voluminous it seemed almost to swallow him and appeared to read. Pimley felt the psychic force rising past them and through them, to the skylight and through that too, rising to the beam that ran directly above Algol, working against it, chipping and eroding and rubbing relentlessly against the grain, eating holes in the magic, working patiently to put out the eyes of the bear, to crack the shell of the turtle, to break the beam which ran from Shardik to Maturin, to topple the dark tower which stood between. Pimley turned to his companion, and wasn't surprised to realize he could now see the cunning little teeth in the Tego's weasel head. Smiling at last. Nor was he surprised to realize he could read the black eyes. Tahin, under ordinary circumstances, could send and receive some very simple mental communication, but not be progged. Here, though, all that changed. Here. Here. Finley Otego was at peace. His concerns, Hinky Dai-Dai, were gone, at least for the time being. Pimley sent Finley a series of bright images, a champagne bottle breaking over the stern of a boat, hundreds of flat black graduation caps rising in the air, a flag being planted on Mount Everest, a laughing couple escaping a church with their heads bent against a pelting storm of rice. A planet, Earth, suddenly glowing with fierce brilliance. Images that all said the same thing.
Yes, Finley said,
and Pimley wondered how he could ever have thought those eyes hard to read.
Yes, indeed. Success at the end of the day.
Neither of them looked down at that moment. Had they done, they would have seen Ted Brodigan, an old dog, yes, and tired, but perhaps not quite as tired as some thought, looking up at them with a ghost of his own smile. 9. There was never rain out here, at least not during Pimley's years, but sometimes, in the Stygian blackness of its nights, there were great volleys of dry thunder. Most of the Divar Toys staff had trained themselves to sleep through these fusillades, but Pimley often woke up, heart hammering in his throat, the Our Father running through his mostly unconscious mind like a circle of spinning red ribbon. Earlier that day, talking to Finley, the master of Algol Siento had used the phrase Hinky Dai-Dai with a self-conscious smile, and why not? It was a child's phrase, almost like Olly Olly Infree or Eeny Meeny Miny Mo. Now, lying in his bed at Shapley House, known as Shit House to the Breakers, a full mall's length away from Damley House, Pimley remembered the feeling, the flat-out certainty, that everything was going to be okay. Success assured, only a matter of time. On the balcony, Finley had shared it, but Pimley wondered if his security chief was now lying awake as Pimley himself was, and thinking how easy it was to be misled when you were around working Breakers. Because, do you, they sent up that happy gas, that good mind vibe. And suppose, just suppose now, someone was actually channeling that feeling, sending it up to them like a lullaby. Go to sleep, Pimley. Go to sleep, Finley. Go to sleep, all of you good children. Ridiculous idea. Totally paranoid.
Still, when another double boom of thunder rolled out of what might still be the southeast, from the direction of Fedek and the Discordia anyway, Pimley Prentice sat up and turned on the bedside lamp. Finley had spoken of doubling the guard tonight, both in the watchtowers and along the fences. Perhaps tomorrow they might triple it, just to be on the safe side. And because complacency this close to the end would be a very bad thing indeed. Pimley got out of bed, a tall man with a hairy slab of gut, now wearing blue pajama pants and nothing else. He pissed, then knelt in front of the toilet's lowered lid, folded his hands, and prayed until he felt sleepy. He prayed to do his duty. He prayed to see trouble before trouble saw him. He prayed for his ma, just as Jim Jones had prayed for his as he watched the line move toward the tub of poisoned Kool-Aid. He prayed until the thunder had died to little more than a senile mutter, then went back into bed, calm again. His last thought before drifting off was about tripling the guard first thing in the morning, and that was the first thing he thought of when he woke to a room awash in artificial sunlight. Because you had to take care of the eggs when you were almost home. Chapter 7 Kashum 1 A feeling both blue and strange crept among the gunslingers after Brodigan and his friends left. But at first no one spoke of it. Each of them thought that melancholy belonged to him or her alone. Roland, who might have been expected to know the feeling for what it was, Kashum, Court would have called it, ascribed it instead to worries about the following day, and even more, to the debilitating atmosphere of Thunderclap, where day was dim and night was as dark as blindness. Certainly there was enough to keep them busy after the departure of Brodigan, Earnshaw, and Shimi Ruiz, that friend of Roland's childhood. Both Susanna and Eddie had attempted to talk to the gunslinger about Shimi, and Roland had shaken them off. Jake, strong in the touch, hadn't even tried. Roland wasn't ready to talk about those old days again, at least not yet. There was a path leading down and around the flank of Steak Titi, and they found the cave of which the old man had told them behind a cunning camouflage of rocks and desert dusty bushes. This cave was much bigger than the one above, with gas lanterns hung from spikes that had been driven into the rock walls. Jake and Eddie lit two of these on each side, and the four of them examined the cave's contents in silence. The first thing Roland noticed was the sleeping bags. A quartet lined up against the left-hand wall, each considerately placed on an inflated air mattress. The tags on the bags read, "Property of U.S. Army." Beside the last of these, a fifth air mattress had been covered with a layer of bath towels. They were expecting four people and one animal, the gunslinger thought. Precognition? Or have they been watching us somehow? And does it matter? There was a plastic swaddled object sitting on a barrel marked Danger, Munitions. Eddie removed the protective plastic and revealed a machine with reels on it. One of the reels was loaded. Roland could make nothing of the single word on the front of the speaking machine and asked Susanna what it was. "Wallensack," she said, "a German company. When it comes to these things, they make the best." "Not no mo', sugar bee," Eddie said. "In my wen, we like to say Sony, no baloney. They make a tape player you can clip right to your belt. It's called a Walkman. I bet this dinosaur weighs 20 pounds. More with the batteries." Susanna was examining the unmarked tape boxes that had been stacked beside the Wallensack. There were three of them. "I can't wait to hear what's on these," she said.
"After the daylight goes, maybe," Roland said. "For now, let's see what else we've got here."
"Roland?" Jake asked. The gunslinger turned toward him. There was something about the boy's face that almost always softened Roland's own. Looking at Jake did not make the gunslinger handsome, but seemed to give his features a quality they didn't ordinarily have. Susanna thought it was the look of love, and perhaps some thin hope for the future.
"What is it, Jake?"
"I know we're going to fight. Join us next week for Return to the O.K. Corral, starring Van Heflin and Lee Van Cleef," Eddie murmured, walking toward the back of the cave.
There, a much larger object had been covered with what looked like a quilted mover's pad.
"But when?" Jake continued. "Will it be tomorrow?"
"Perhaps," Roland replied. "I think the day after is more likely."
"I have a terrible feeling," Jake said. "It's not being afraid, exactly."
"Do you think they're going to beat us, hon?" Susanna asked. She put a hand on Jake's neck and looked into his face. She had come to respect his feelings. She sometimes wondered how much of what he was now had to do with the creature he'd faced to get here. The thing in the house on Dutch Hill. No robot there, no rusty old clockwork toy. The doorkeeper had been a genuine leftover of the Prim. "You smell a whoopin' in the wind?
That it?" "I don't think so," Jake said. "I don't know what it is. I've only felt something like it once, and that was just before..."
"Just before what?" Susanna asked, but before Jake had a chance to reply, Eddie broke in. Roland was glad. "Just before I fell." That was how Jake had meant to finish. "Just before Roland let me fall."
"Holy shit, come here, you guys, you gotta see this."
Eddie had pulled away the mover's pad and revealed a motorized vehicle that looked like a cross between an ATV and a gigantic tricycle. The tires were wide balloon jobs with deep zigzag treads. The controls were all on the handlebars, and there was a playing card propped on the rudimentary dashboard. Roland knew what it was even before Eddie plucked it up between two fingers and turned it over. The card showed a woman with a shawl over her head at a spinning wheel. It was the Lady of Shadows.
"Looks like our pal Ted left you a ride, Sugarbee," Eddie said.
Susanna had hurried over at her rapid crawl. Now she lifted her arms.
"Boost me up, boost me, Eddie."
He did, and when she was in the saddle, holding handlebars instead of reins, the vehicle looked made for her. Susanna thumbed a red button, and the engine thrummed to life, so low you could barely hear it. Electricity, not gasoline, Eddie was quite sure, like a golf cart, but probably a lot faster. Susanna turned toward them, smiling radiantly. She patted the three-wheeler's dark brown nacelle.
"Call me Mrs. Centaur. I've been looking for this my whole life and never even knew."
None of them noticed the stricken expression on Roland's face. He bent over to pick up the card Eddie had dropped so no one would. Yes, it was her, all right. The Lady of the Shadows. Under her shawl, she seemed to be smiling craftily and sobbing both at the same time. On the last occasion he'd seen that card, it had been in the hand of the man who sometimes went by the name of Walter, sometimes at a flag. "You have no idea how close you stand to the tower now," he had said. "Worlds turn about your head." And now he recognized the feeling that had crept among them for what it almost certainly was. Not worry or weariness, but kashum. There was no real translation for that rue-laden term, but it meant to sense an approaching break in one's quartet. Walter O'Dim, his old nemesis, was dead. Roland had known it as soon as he saw the face of the Lady of Shadows. Soon one of his own would die as well, probably in the coming battle to break the power of the Divartoi. And once again the scales which had temporarily tilted in their favor would balance. It never once crossed Roland's mind that the one to die might be him.